Good morning, KURU listeners. Welcome to Kindred Continuum's Resilient Voices show. This week, we have a spinoff from our criminal justice special that we aired in January. Today, we'll be talking about dialogue and restorative practices, both within and outside of our criminal justice system. Our guests today are Pamela Morgan, who is a massage therapist and mental health counselor, and has been involved with organizations that promote nonviolence. Dr. Edward Philandra is the senior editor for Living Justice Press from the Great Sioux Nation. And Stefan Lucchini is a nonviolent activist and restorative justice practitioner. Before we get started, I would like to acknowledge that we are airing this program from the traditional territory of the Chiricahua and Warm Springs Apache Nations, also known as Grant County, New Mexico. After our criminal justice dialogue aired, Pamela called me to say that she liked this show, which is always nice to hear, and yet she thought one more important perspective was missing, that of victims. Pamela, can you please share the story you told me that day after having your home burglarized and what followed?
Yeah, this was about 20 years ago. I was living in Fort Collins. And a young man named Brian he was 16, and he had burglarized several houses in my neighborhood, including mine. Of course, I found this out afterwards. He was caught. He had stolen the keys from my upstairs neighbor, and he was caught coming back to steal her car. And so he was up for, I guess, grand larceny, or even though he didn't steal the car. And besides being annoyed, the stuff he stole from me wasn't particularly valuable, but it was sentimental. There was some jewelry in there that was very sentimental to me. I actually found myself being really concerned for the kid. He was 16. He had been in and out of foster care. He was high on meth. And I thought, this is a terrible way to start a life in prison. Well, so I stayed in touch with the case. I mean, he owed me $180. So I don't remember the details. I'm sorry, but I was in touch with a woman in the legal system. Maybe she was a police officer. And at one point, I realized I wanted to meet him, because to me, this was a crime between him and me. You know, the law got all involved. But it was something that happened to me and to all the individuals on the street, each of the individuals on the street. And then it gets taken away from the personal damage that's done when it goes into the legal system. I wanted to meet the kid. I just felt like I needed to do that. And I also had a dog at home, and I was curious, why did my dog not stop him and scare him away? A big tough dog. And the woman I was in touch with did not understand what I wanted. She thought I wanted to confront him and demand something from him, or that I was going to get really upset and cry. And I was like, no, I just, you know what? I actually care about the guy. I just want to see how he's doing. I want to talk to him person to person, tell him how what he did affected me. So she set it up. He was in some kind of rehabilitation detention center in Denver. And he had taken, before I got there, I don't think because I was going there, but I think all of them took a class where they had to understand the victim's perspective. So he'd had some emotional preparation for this. And I go in, and there's like five other people in there. I don't know, probation officer and this person and that person and me and him. And we had a conversation, and I just asked him about him coming in my house. And I said, why didn't my dog scare you off? And he said, I was high on meth and I just screamed at your dog and she cowered and left me alone. And then he told me that he hid the stuff he stole from me under a bush a few houses away from where I lived. He described it well enough that I could figure out which bush it was. I brought a gift for him. I actually had a book around. I hadn't read it, but it was called The Spiritual Advantages of a Painful Childhood. I thought maybe he can learn something from this. And I gave him the book, and he got tears in his eyes. I just got the feeling that he was thrown, that maybe people didn't give him stuff. And in, particularly in this situation where he is the offender. And I left, and that was that. And I went to the bush and talked to the neighbors, asked them if I could dig around in there. It's a really thick bush. I didn't find any of the sentimental items. I don't know if birds took them off or what happened to them. I did find the packages of gum that he stole from the neighbor upstairs. I never got the $180 from him, but there it was. And it was very satisfying to have that human contact, not just for me, but apparently for him too.
Wow, that's just such a remarkable story. And that one of the things that really strikes me is that you knew what you needed, that the system itself was not providing, and you pursued it. And I'm guessing that not only was that a positive experience for you and for the kid, but also for the other people, the probation officers and social workers, whoever else were involved in the case, to observe that. What are your most important takeaways from that experience?
Empowerment, that you can move in the legal system somewhat to get your needs met. There is some leeway, I'm sure, given the right people that you talk to. And there was something about making a connection with him. And I could feel it in the whole room. There was like this warmth, this silence, almost like a sacred silence in the room. Making a human connection. This kid to me was not a criminal, and I wasn't a victim. We were just two human beings having a moment with each other of truth.
Yeah. Did you ever find out what happened to him or hear from him anything?
I just went through my journal today looking to see if I'd written any details about this. I didn't really, but I found his name written down. I'm going to try to Google him, see if I can't find where he ended up.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that story with us. And it seemed like there were some... Yeah. You know, some needs that you recognized and were able to pursue that just weren't being offered as a part of the, you know, the conventional justice system process at that time. So this kind of brings us to the idea of dialogue and also restorative justice. But I thought we'd maybe start with a little discussion about dialogue, because you had a dialogue with him. I mean, heck, he told you where to find the stuff he had stolen. And what he did with your dog. So you got that question answered. So I looked up the definition of dialogue in the Oxford Languages Dictionary, and it says to take part in a conversation to resolve a problem. That's a pretty simple definition when we're talking about is restorative justice and so on. Stefan, do you have a definition of dialogue that you like to use?
Yeah, I'm not going to limit it to solving problems, anything that has to be fixed. I think dialogue is really simply where people are actually listening. They're not just talking.
How do you know when
maybe
people are
listening?
Maybe there's
a healthy balance where when I feel like I, as a speaker, feel like people are acknowledging me, that I feel validated, I feel heard for my ideas and those things that are important to me. That people hear something about me that's not just the words that I said, but it's deeper than that. And dialogue is reciprocal in that when I feel and experience that, I find myself better listening to somebody else, more interested in what's not just said in words, but what else is meant. And so I think dialogue is this process where we go deeper than just our words. We're no longer defending ourselves in argument or debate, but we're actually truly listening.
Thank you. Edward, do you have anything you'd like to add to that as far as how we define dialogue or what that means to you?
Yeah, well, thank you. Gosh, you know, as Pam was talking, I was taking some notes and I thought that the process, the conventional wisdom that we go through really does prohibit, you know, like an informal dialogue or relational type of dialogue, because it's so process oriented. And there's certain roles that people play when they enter into like a criminal justice system. Pam was very clear that there's these labels or terminology that go with it, victim, offender, And even those kind of phrases set up a certain kind of understanding and expectations and assumptions. And people are socialized to think that way. So unconventionally, when Pamela asked to talk to this young person, that I'm sure, and she alluded to the fact that, you know, was it to engage this person perhaps in a retributive way? So even that had a certain amount of expectation around it. But her approach, I think, really broke some of the understandings that people have when they enter into this. And then to have this dialogue, what came to my mind was this notion of being in relation and also having some sense of accountability embedded in that, you know, just wanting to know and understand this person. I think dialogue, you know, the definition, and I think what Stefan has said too, is something that I would say is organic and really informal. But also there's this understanding of wanting to reach out and understand this other person's perspective. I think that's part of it. That's missing in the process, because I'll air quote victim, but victims a lot of times in these criminal justice systems just go along with that process because that's how it's set up. And for Pamela to take the initiative and break that mold a little bit, I think is part of the restorative justice or restorative practice understanding.
Thank you. And so far we've been talking about dialogue and restorative practices in terms of one-on-one. You know, there's somebody who's done something and then there's another person who has been kind of on the receiving end of harm. And one of the things, you know, kind of referring to what we were talking about, you know, before this show, is how can dialogue processes be employed at other levels of our society? Say, for instance, you know, among several people, say at work or in a neighborhood, within professions, religious or spiritual communities, and so on. At the national level, and I was thinking of the South Africa Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings that they had. Who would like to speak about that? You know, how those conversations maybe manifest differently at different levels.
There was an article that I read 5 or 6 years ago about a group that created a dialogue around gun control, and it took about 100 people from around the country, and they first had to go through a 3-day workshop on learning how to listen, to truly listen, and on how to ask questions that aren't biased or leading, but truly open to learning something, to learning the perspective of the other person. And then they put these people together and they had dialogue about gun control, and these are people from all different perspectives. So that's a very structured way to have a dialogue amongst a number of people from differing perspectives.
And can you say something about what came out of that process? I've heard of similar processes around other really hot topics. Do you remember what came from that?
No, I do not. I do not remember what came out of that one. I do remember that Oprah had put together like 10 people around a table, and they had a lot of different topics, and it started out well. They listened to each other, but then it broke down by the end. Some topic came up and they couldn't control themselves anymore, started interrupting and getting angry, and the whole process broke down.
You know, I'm wondering if that whole 3-day training prior to the gun to dialogue maybe made a difference in that one. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, because we don't just know how to have these difficult conversations. I mean, we all know from, you know, our families and our close relationships that if something's important to us and somebody comes in with a really different perspective or opinion, we can get really triggered. Our amygdala are activated and it actually makes it hard for us to even think clearly, much less listen well. So you can't just say, yeah, dialogue is great, let's do it. You have to develop the actual skills, it seems like. Who else would like to weigh in on that? Any thoughts, Stefan or Edward?
Yeah, I think for dialogue to be effective, you have other elements. For example, people have to have a sense of safety. Safety includes respect, that they feel like they will be, people will interact with them with respect and recognition. And I can see easily how a dialogue can fall apart as well. Having facilitated dialogue where a relationship is first built between the participants individually with the facilitator helps the participants feel safe. It contributes to that safety. They start to feel a trust with the practitioner. And then when it comes to a dialogue with the others who may have different views or actually may be, you know, in a more of a difference between a person who's caused harm and people who've been harmed, dialogue between them, where safety is so important, having that trust built, each of them individually first with a facilitator is very important. There are going to be other elements as well. I would like to give a little example of a story with a conflict that happened. Somebody in a professional workplace, I used restorative dialogue and when asked to facilitate, to help as a mediator, a conflict in the workplace. And person came to me and said, I have caused harm. I did something wrong. And I've said some things in the course of this work relationship with a number of other people. And I don't know how to go about apologizing, but I want to. And I want to try to make things right because the relationship is really important to me. And so I spent some time with that person one-on-one, including some capacity building, which we call that capacity building, where we try to help a person through coaching, is another word we use to help them see how they speak contributes to conflict, and for them to see or anticipate, you know, that they may have actually harmed somebody, how they would have harmed them. And I also then met with other people in that workplace, and at some point they said, yes, we'll go ahead and meet, and they did have dialogue together. And we use that restorative process of guided by the questions, what happened and who's been affected and who's contributed to the harm and how. And that person took ownership and realized the harm that they'd caused without actually knowing what it was beforehand. The so-called offending worker had known that they did something hurtful, but they didn't really understand how hurtful it was until they heard it from the voice of the other workers. And there's much more to say about it. It's not centrally focused on the one who offended, but then the people who were affected, they had voice and they had power to say how they were hurt. And that was healing for them and restoring for them as well. So that's an application of a restore process of dialogue, even outside of a criminal justice context.
Thank you. Edward?
Well, you know, I'm really enjoying the conversation because so many ideas come to mind and write down these little notes. But I agree that, at least from my perspective and my experience with having what we call difficult conversations or dialogues, particularly on really core issues, stories are important to listen to affirm those stories, no matter how discomforting they are. I think one of the things that, in my experience too, coming in as a Lakota into, let's say, a white circle, an RJ circle, there are so many microaggressions that happen. You know, there has to be some kind of pre-meeting understanding about how someone like me can go into a mixed race circle and feel very uncomfortable and very unsafe because I'm not really knowing maybe other people's stories or hearing what they have to say. So a lot of times for me, dialogue, whether it's one-on-one or collective, there has to be an educational component to that for sure. I come from the framework of decolonization, so I'm willing to call bullshit when I see it and hear it, because that's part of the deconstruction. But I also realize it's in the delivery of how that happens. So I'm always very self-aware of the way the words that I say, because I know I've been in dialogues that went south immediately and nothing really got accomplished. So I think, you know, this notion of dialogue is, especially when you have mixed race circles or mixed groups, we all have different understandings from our experiences in life. And again, you know, there can be so many unintended or intended microaggressions that can somehow derail a good dialogue. So I don't know. I just think there has to be some level of trust, safety. Story has to be a component of that. It has always, I would have to say, dialogues have often been a challenge for me. Always.
Okay, so what is it that makes a dialogue process safe? Who would like to go first? Okay, Stefan, go ahead.
There are a whole lot of things I can list as I think of them. But from what Edward was just saying, it's making me think about how culturally people have different ways of coming together and ways of kind of establishing, getting to know each other, establishing trust and safety first. Some of that people are familiar with in their cultures. Some of it, I think there's wisdom in cultures where we can learn in other cultures from that. One thing I learned is as much as possible in bringing people together around a particular matter, whatever sort of dialogue is, helping people be empowered, not only in their voice, but how they can say things. And I've had it where people, I've been able to facilitate where people actually themselves defined how they were going to have their dialogue. It wasn't me prescribing, oh, this is how it's going to be, or this is how it has to happen, or pick and choose one of these. You know, actually people found their voice and their power. And as the relationship was building between all the different parties in the group, they found ways to best have dialogue, to hear each other best. And through that was healing as well. And finding a resolution that was to whatever matters that were truly meaningful to them. So that's the best of all possible worlds, is when people do that themselves. And I think we can all assume that people can and work towards helping that happen.
Okay. So maybe it makes sense to, you know, start with that assumption that people are capable. In practice, though, is everybody capable of communicating in that way? Because we're talking about a high level of skill, really, that maybe can be developed through workshops or coaching. What about the times when someone can't really get there? And can you speak to maybe what are some obstacles? What are barriers to successful dialogue? Like maybe intercultural stuff.
I'll speak to from much of my experience when I acted as a facilitator in dialogue where there was conflict or where there was harm done. And so I would contact people and introduce myself as a facilitator who is not there to take sides, but actually there to support everybody in the best way possible, to have a voice, have a choice, and be part of finding a best way to make things right or resolve conflicts. And through that introduction, people would feel, okay, I'm willing to listen to you. And we would individually talk and privately and first, and that would help people understand what dialogue was. They would understand the frameworks through framing of the issues, for example. I won't use the word offender or victim. I talk about something's happened, people have been involved in it and affected by it. And this is to talk about that, to help people through that and a way to find a way to help repair the harm and make things right. And people would rise up to that and step in and agree to participate. So there's a building of trust, a building of understanding of what to expect. That helps people feel safe to be in an environment that was neutral. So those are those micro things in the beginning to help set the stage for making dialogue work, for people to have the experience of feeling heard and understood by the facilitator, the mediator. Like, oh, wow, yeah, people will say, you know, they hadn't found their own words and I could offer a way to look at it in my own words. And they would say, yeah, that sounds right. And that would help them find more of their own voice.
Now, Edward, would you like to add on to that?
You know, I think one of the major things I think that influenced the direction of dialogue, speaking as an Indigenous person from the Ocheti Shakoni and having many dialogues with settlers, we actually come from just two very different histories of experience. And I think that is, you know, that is probably one of the major, most major obstacles that I have encountered, and I think other Indigenous peoples too, is there's just a lot of assumptions built into what it is to be an American. And those assumptions are often structurally violent against Indigenous peoples. So there is no recognition of the structural violence that's built into the U.S. And I think that becomes very difficult because as one begins to lay out the context for a dialogue, for example, land return, even under the best circumstances, there's a lot of defensiveness that comes into that. And it's really hard to deconstruct that because there's so many myths built around the founding of the United States, for example. And it can be done, but it takes a lot of effort. And I think one can assume that, let's say, for example, an Indigenous experience mirrors the immigrant experience. Or, you know, one can assume that from mainstream that an Indigenous experience, be it education, be it employment, are relatable. I mean, those are just two different kind of experiences that we have. And I think one of the most challenging things, and I hear Stefan talk about that, and Pamela allude to it, is this notion of trust. And I think that is probably one of the most difficult things in my experience in dealing with non-Indigenous peoples on trying to address some kind of harm, for example, or what kind of challenges are there that we need to talk about in order to move to the next level. So those are the kind of things. And, you know, there's a lot of values in the States about, you know, being process heavily oriented toward process and outcomes and takeaways. Whereas we don't necessarily think that should be like a means to an end. There's something to be said about just getting to know each other on a relational level. You know, I often find when I engage non-Indigenous people, if I just say, "What's your story?" Oh, they just open up, as opposed to, "Where are you from? What do you do?" You know, those kind of things. And so I think there has to be some awareness that we do come from totally different worlds, and it can impact dialogue. It can impact the circle process as well. So just that awareness, I think, is there. You know, what an Indigenous person may say can make people feel defensive. And, you know, a lot of people will personalize those kind of things too, which is really hard to kind of, you know, it goes to show that their American identity is so tied in with the mythologies and how they think that they can personalize a lot of the what's said in the dialogue and also then become very defensive. And it's almost a classic like shutdown. So, I mean, there's tons of challenges.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, when we're talking about dialogues between peoples, Indigenous people, Black people, Tino or Hispanic, Chicano people, immigrants, and then, you know, the white majority in this country that has that structural power that is so often just completely unaware that that's even there. That's a pretty big barrier, because what I found in trying to have dialogues around the topic of race and power in America, even just using that word, you know, it's so charged right there, America. It's almost like you have to have the people involved, or the, you know, the people who are less aware of that kind of built-in violence in the structure of our society, have them go through, you know, a few semesters of classes just to be able to have that one conversation about the one thing that maybe happened between these two individuals. The thing itself might not seem like that huge, but it's all tied to the fabric of our society, which includes all of the harm that has been done from the moment Europeans set foot on these shores and things began, right? I found that very difficult myself, and just in having conversations with people and where they or I have not done harm to each other. It's just having a conversation. It's very challenging. And I think that, you know, it really adds like so many really deep layers to that. So I guess my takeaway, kind of what I'm getting out of this, is that those kinds of restorative conversations are much easier to have internally to people who are from the same group, same community, same history and background. So you don't have to plow through all that other stuff, but the intercultural stuff is kind of, you know, pretty massive. I'd like to get Pamela's thoughts on what we've been discussing so far. What's come up for you, Pamela?
You know, it takes a certain amount of maturity and vulnerability to have a quality dialogue. I don't know. We're not very good listeners in this American non-Indigenous society. I think to create a quality dialogue, I think, and to create safety, if people would could really realize that they're going to get their turn to speak too. Each, you know, if you can set up parameters, each person's going to get their turn. You know, I think we tend to rush in and interrupt each other or not listen because we're planning our own response. No, there's going to be time in a set up dialogue where each person's going to get their turn. So if you can accept that, you're going to be a better listener and hopefully you'll feel safer. And something that's helped me a lot is to understand that there's always I call it a good reason. I'll explain what that means in a minute. There's always a good reason why somebody does what they do and believes what they believe. And when I say a good reason, that means internally it makes sense to that person. So it can help us to respect someone else to realize that their beliefs, their worldview comes out of their life experiences. And some of that might be family and cultural history passed down to them. And so internally, it makes sense. There's a cohesion there, and that's their good reason for believing and acting the way they do. If we can get curious about somebody else and wanting to know their story, you know, I love that Ed brought up story. We can have a dialogue. We can have a give and take. We can have a sharing. I read somewhere that once we know somebody's story, it's so much easier to fall in love with them. So those are some of the thoughts coming up.
Thank you very much. Yeah, so some of what I'm getting out of what you all are saying is number one is there has to be a certain level of trust, and connected to trust is a perception on the part of all parties that the other participants are engaging that process genuinely. Like they have a genuine desire to understand each other. And that, you know, that means that listening to understand, not to refute, which is a hard skill for me to learn. And I have a hard time maintaining that still, even though I've practiced a lot. It's an ongoing thing. So that's really big. Just not just trusting people just on that sort of general fundamental level, but believing that they are engaging that process genuinely and that they're being honest. That's connected to it too, both intellectually and emotionally, that they're truly sharing their own perspective and their story and their responses to our perspectives and stories. And then patience. That's a really big one. I think one of the hardest things that I had to learn about listening is to be comfortable with silence. I think in our broader society in the US, we have this thing about silence, this difficulty with just there being quietness and space to kind of consider our response. And that's one of the things I really love about circle processes and other facilitated dialogue processes is that there's a space that's just cleared and set for each individual as the process goes on. And it's understood that the other people have to just sit there and then try to really be present when someone is speaking and really take that in and allow, even say in a circle, for instance, as the talking piece is going from person to person, the sense internally of what you might want to respond to when it gets to be your turn can change based on all the things that are being said. So it's like maybe somebody way across the circle will say something and it's like, oh yeah, I really want to say this about that. But then if you really stay present with that process as other people are speaking, then our own internal placement in that conversation can shift. And in a way, at least the way I've experienced it as a participant and as a facilitator, is that it's almost like we start to become of one mind, even as we are individuals with our differences in perspective. I think it's sort of like there's some kind of magic, I think, that happens there. And I think that that can take the edge off of the angst that people can come into, you know, some more difficult conversations with. And that even if we leave the conversations still with our basic opinions and attitudes still intact, at least it seems like there's an ability for people to not experience each other so much as other and the enemy.
I really think what Pamela said that struck me was, you know, this, what internally makes sense to a person. I think that would be worth noting that, because life experiences, as Pam said, really contributes to that. You know, what internally makes sense? And I guess that just raises the question of what internally makes sense to me may not come across that way with other people. So I guess that really begs the question of how does that get articulated to understand that person better? Because I think I've ran across that many times in my life and in different kinds of dialogues where I think that person's worldview or understanding of the world doesn't seem to shake hands with what is being talked about or what is being said. So I really thought that was an insightful comment about internally make sense to that person. And I was just thinking about the recent events over the last few months. There's a large segment of the society that to them, there's a lot of things that make sense to them, but yet to a lot of other people just seems to be things are off the rails. So if there's any dialogue on that that should happen, it should be about trying to understand why that person sees the world in that particular way. And I think that's, I want to thank Pam for that, because I probably tend to forget that at times too. This person's behavior, this person's choice of words, this person's body language may really convey a lot more messaging and doesn't come across as rational to me, I would argue. I don't know. It just made me think about Pam's comment, just got me thinking about that too.
Pamela?
Yeah, I have had a fantasy for a long time of creating a dialogue. Well, it could be a radio show or it wouldn't have to be in public at all. But having two individuals from across the chasm of belief come together, and I'd be a facilitator, I would love to have them talk about why they believe what they believe and have the other person listen. I'm not saying that would be easy, and it could probably require a lot of training beforehand, and these people have to be willing to do that. But I would just love to do that, you know, pro-life, pro-choice. Where does that passion come from? And for the other person to get, oh, that's, there's a good reason for that, that you believe in that. I hear you. I see that. Wouldn't that be lovely? And then my fear is if I were to engage in a conversation like that with someone, let's say one of the people that, one of the insurrectionists, right? I'm curious, what are their beliefs? You know, I'd like to grab a person and talk to them and really get why they believe what they believe and they're so passionate about it. But what would be hard for me is I'm sure they would not be able to listen back and hear, why do I believe what I believe?
Pamela, can I speak to that? I'm going to piece a few things together to offer a different view. I think perhaps there's an experience among the people who became insurrectionists of feeling not heard. not having a voice and not having a sense of power and having a sense of the power slipping away. And I'm not talking about any idea of like white power or our identity is this is a white nation and all that stuff. I'm talking about how the economy has, that people were comfortable with up into the 80s has progressively degraded to where we're even having a discussion about a $15 minimum wage. It's still $7.50. And many of those people don't realize, why it's that way. And, the wealth distribution in this country and the power of a few people. I think what's happened is that those people are feeling very disempowered. They don't feel like they have as much of a future, perhaps. And they found a voice. They found something to follow, somebody who they could relate to somehow. Unfortunately, that has happened in other, historically in other times as well, resulting in horrible things, genocides and such. At this time, somebody was able to get themselves as president to have other people follow them and into insurrection. So I think if we're willing to ask the question, be curious and genuinely ask, what are you feeling and what's going on? Go peel that onion, so to speak, and go deeper. We might find some answers in that they're not all this superficial label that's easy for us right now politically to cast on them.
Thanks, Stefan. Yeah, and I think that kind of circles back around to the willingness of people to engage genuinely. That's a big hurdle, is even just getting people to the table. It can be done. There's lots of examples of that being done, that it's definitely not a sure thing. And one of the thoughts that I've had come up when encountering resistance to dialogue, there is this identity piece that I think is really powerful. For instance, Pamela, you were mentioning pro-choice versus pro-life. And I think that in some of these values-based conflicts that are deeply rooted in a sense of self and this orientation to reality, those are always tougher because it's not just about the details of why people believe what they believe, but also a sense of who they are. And I wonder about that as far as this bigger conflict that our whole nation is in right now between the left and the right, Democrat and Republican. And I think that we really, really underestimate the power of just, it's our team. You know, we vote for our team every time, even if we don't always like the team leader so much. We don't always like the coach. We don't always like all the players. It's our team. I mean, we have that. We see that in sports. And so I think it's got to be at least that powerful when it comes to politics, that there's something that really transcends rationality. But even more than that, what happens to somebody? And I know people like this. We were talking about Marv Kammerer earlier, who have become outcasts in their communities, in their social circles, in a sense, and their own families, because they have taken on and advocated for perspectives that are considered just absolutely unacceptable by the members of their, you know, natural communities, extensions of their families and where they live and the professions they're in and that kind of thing. It makes me think about the risks that people can take by engaging in these deeper, genuine dialogues and having that willingness to be changed by them. And I know that I've experienced pushback sometimes in conversations about, you know, the other, whoever the other happens to be in that conversation, and had been basically accused of, you know, kind of, it's like being told you're a traitor to your own people, however that's being defined in that particular conversation. And that's a big risk, because one of the most fundamental needs of human beings is to belong. And who do we belong to? We belong to our families. We belong to the people we grew up with in the communities where we grew up and everything that goes with that. So I just wanted to throw that in there. Thoughts? Edward, you're nodding. Would you like to jump in?
I have to really agree with Stefan. There's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of insecurity that I perceive in the United States. And the radio show is really apropos because if there's any dialogue that's ever needed, it's probably now. However, you know, when I, on the Talking Heads, whether it's OAN, Newsmax, Fox, MSNBC, CNN, if I flip between the two channels, I basically hear at least two different Americas. And I find that really an interesting proposition to be in because it's as if there's two different worlds existing in the same space. It's like matter and antimatter. They're going to cancel each other out in a way that is not good. So these positions have become so extreme and so calcified, whatever middle that there has been or could be is nearly non-existent. So the notion of having this radio show about dialogue, I think is very apropos. Again, I'm very uncertain how people in the States are going to handle this great divide. And as someone who doesn't consider themselves part of the system, but lives in the belly of the beast, I find it just really a fascinating thing to be on the sideline and watch this go on and just wonder how Americans are going to reconcile themselves, perhaps to the fact that there's two different societies operating in the same geography. And that would be interesting to see if they can reconcile two different societies and acknowledge that and perhaps make some kind of arrangement to accommodate those two different views rather than trying to force a square peg into a round hole. I think that's the next level of discussion that's going to require an enormous amount of dialogue.
Yeah, I find myself wondering, is that even possible? Because when you're talking, I really love the terminology you use, the antimatter and matter and the calcification. Those are great terms to use for what's happening. And that kind of circles back around to the issue of trust and the issue of willingness. We have to put our arms down in order to shake hands, right? And to begin connection and develop connection that's genuine. I liked what Stefan was saying about thinking in terms of fundamental needs, like decent jobs, just something that basic, people being able to take care of their families, minimum wage not having changed in forever. It's just absurd. I think back in the 80s, I was making $5.25 an hour. That was a really long time ago, you know, along with that. So there's the fundamental needs that people have, those basic needs. But then there's the framing of what those needs are. And that's where we can't even have this conversation without things like race or gender equality and reproductive rights and that kind of stuff being in there, because all of those things and other dimensions, class also, for instance, come to play in individuals' framing of what the problem is and how it can be solved. Those things just, they're part of the fabric of our society, and they are pulled into all of these discussions. I don't know. I don't have solutions. I think one of the things about doing this show is that, I mean, if we're really digging into some of these issues, it's not like in an hour we're going to come up with the magic solution, the wand or whatever. And I want so much to kind of end on a positive note, like a sense of hope and there's something that we can grasp and move forward with. And, you know, things aren't always that easy. However, we are getting close to the end of our time together on this topic. And I'm wondering, there's something like really in your mind that you would, you know, you really want to say on this topic. That's great. Go ahead and say it. And also just some last words, like how we can move forward, what maybe the listeners can do, an intention you're setting.
I think we can focus on our own strengths. I would like to see more people and myself bring what we want, be the world that we want to create. We have to bring it. And so we can bring the patience, the willingness, the motivation to have dialogue with whoever is willing to, right? Let's start with the easy ones, people who are willing to have dialogue. We keep our heart open and share the love. I mean, that just has positive impact. We may never get to the difficult conversations. I don't know, but there are things that we can do and love and patience and willingness that we can bring.
Oh, thank you, Pamela. Yeah. We all have all these hours every day that we're interacting with the world around us, including other people. And maybe there's something about setting an intention to be open and, you know, less reactive and more open to engaging genuinely. Stefan?
Yeah, at this moment, I'm at this kind of fundamental thought of what world do I want to live in? The world immediately around me, my sphere or the larger world. How do I want to be when there's conflict or difference of view or opinion? Do I want to be right? Do I want to silence the other side by destroying them, by shutting them out, by shouting? Or, I mean, the only alternative is if we don't want those, then we have to listen. And in listening, we're truly listening. We're not preparing our rebuttal. It's not but, it's and my thoughts and theirs. And from that, then we can get somewhere in this world where we can share the same planet and actually feel okay with each other. It's a pretty simple choice. And once we've made that choice, not all of us are really good at it. We have to learn the skills, but we can do that. We can learn from each other. We can tell each other our story.
Thank you, Stefan. Edward?
Well, for one thing, you know, it may not sound hopeful, but I do say that what people are experiencing in the States is certainly not sustainable. And the paradigms that people have relied on since 1492 or since 1776 have got to be rethought, reexamined, restated. And what that means, it's going to require some very difficult conversations. So I come out saying this is not a sustainable society any longer. There are just too many cracks, too many gaps, too many positions that people have taken. So we have this polarity, you know, in a lot of ways to tell us that it's not sustainable any longer. Question is, and then it becomes, and I think Pam and Stefan have touched upon it, is like, what are people willing to do then to make it more sustainable over the long term? But the immediate challenge right now is it's not working. There has to be a restatement and rethinking of the way things have been operating for the last 2, 3, 4 centuries. It's pretty obvious. I mean, you can't ignore the fact. And even Band-Aid solution or kumbaya circles are not going to cut it. So I think it's going to require people to dig deeper into what everyone's going to have to do to make life in the States a little bit more sustainable than it has been over the past, again, centuries. If we keep believing that the way it has been going is fixable, I think that's foolish thinking at this point. So there is a very big need for dialogue. And again, we might just have to reconcile our fact that there may be 2 Americas, 3 Americas, 4 Americas, 5. There might be an untold number of Americas, but that's an outcome of an unsustainable system. It's a backhanded hope, I guess, I'm given.
Thank you, Edward. And thank all of you for joining us here on Resilient Voices. Thank you for your time, your energy, your insights, your heart given to this topic and shared with our listeners.